and I'm erotica. My name is Dottie Shore. Hi.
Hi.
How many of an alcoholics do I have tonight? How many compulsive readers do I have? Great. How many neurotics do I have? A neurotic is a person who makes decisions that are destructive to self. How many neurotics do I have in here tonight? That looks like that's better. That's better. This is a regular Monday night step study meeting for emotionally induced illnesses. And an emotionally induced illness breaks out in many ways. It's our emotions turned in on us, and it manifests itself in alcoholism, compulsive overeating, drug addiction, spastic colitis, migraine headaches, ulcers, asthma, arthritis. I could go on for a long time in telling you what the emotionally induced illnesses are. But it is emotions turned in. It's not that we have a gland that has been affected by a bacteria or a virus. And 85% of people in hospitals today are there as a direct result of an emotionally induced illness. We've taken the AA program and adapted it to ours here. We're not an AA group or not an OA group or an EHA group. We're just kind of our own little group. And we're going on almost 7 years now, which is a great thing. And the only time you'll change a word in anything you hear is in the first step, where we say we admit we're powerless over alcohol. You put your own name there. We don't bother when we read the steps to change all the words in there. It would take too long. So when you hear alcohol or alcoholic, put your own word there. How many people here for the very first time to this meeting? Will you stand, please, and give me your name and what your problem is?
I'm Anna Mueller.
I'm glad to see you, dear.
Marilyn.
Good to see you, Marilyn. And you, dear?
I'm Anna.
Hi. And you?
I'm Alice.
Hi, Alice.
Hi, Alice.
And you, dear?
I'm just Harry. Your name, I've got it.
And you?
Harry.
Hi. Hi. Let's give them a welcome. You are very important to this group, because if we all were the same that was started 7 years ago, it'd be kind of dull. And you are the lifeblood of this group, and I welcome you, and I hope to come back. We open our meeting with the opening prayer. Who'd like to read it for me? Okay, you ought to read it. I think you need it. How's that for taking her inventory?
Hi, my name's Gay, and I'm neurotic and an addict.
Hi, Gay.
Hi, Gay.
Opening prayer. Our Father, we come to you as a friend. You have said that where two or three are gathered together in your name, there you will be in the midst. We believe that you are here with us now. We believe this is something you would have us do, and that it has your blessing. We pledge with you always to be honest and to search our hearts for weaknesses and errors, that we may deserve your help. We believe that you want us to be real partners with you in this business of living, accepting our full responsibilities, and certain that the rewards will be freedom, growth, and happiness. For this we are grateful. We ask you at all times to guide us. Help us daily to come closer to you and grant us new ways of living in gratitude. Amen.
And the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right, now we have one bit of required reading, which is chapter 5 from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and how it works. And John, how about you reading it for me tonight? You just knew I was going to call on you, didn't you?
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol. cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. We're entirely ready to have God remove all of the defects of character. We humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives. B, that we probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he was sought.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. I'm going to have some men in here now because I think we have too many women talking, and I think I better ask my friend Rudy if he'll come up and read the 12 traditions. Just to show you, we have men who have problems too.
We have a lot of problems.
How are you doing?
Good. I haven't seen Dottie for a while.
We just had to have a little kissy poo there.
I'm Rudy and I'm neurotic.
Hi, Rudy.
12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholics who still suffer. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, as problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, and TV. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, darling. I'd like to make a couple of announcements. We have tapes over there on all the talks that I've given, and Marcia, raise your hand. She'll take care of them at the break or after the meeting. And we have literature over here that's most of us marked. The hardback books that we only have two of are marked inside, too. What about my literature chairman? Who's my literature chairman?
I'm OA, and I'm trying to obtain get to a meeting that has enough material.
Well, if you can't, let somebody else get it for you and pay them. Yes.
The Monday night group from when Rudy was taking care of the junior blind donation, they still have our name and they mailed us the helpmate, their 15th card through the junior blind for the Monday night group for the contribution and we want to order.
That's great. Good. For those who are new, we're not an AA group or an OA group, so we can't contribute to them. They won't accept outside contributions, which is our tradition. So we contribute to the junior blind. We pay $10 a week for this hall, plus the literature and the coffee, and anything that's left over is given to the junior blind. And we've done an awful lot for them. And so when you give tonight, remember who you're giving to. We had a multifaceted handicapped child that we sent to camp this year, and we've bought Braille books and playground equipment, and so it's been for a good cause. And those Christmas cards, if you haven't ordered yours and can order from the junior blind, you'll be furthering another good cause. Tonight I'm going to talk on a subject I've never spoken on before, but it's been in my mind for a long time, and I'm going to share it with you. I've learned a lot about it as I've been trying to research on it, and it's called the syndrome of the dry drunk. Does anybody know what a dry drunk is? If you don't know, you'll know, I hope, when I get through. Break down the words for you. Dry is to abstain from drinking, eating, or pill-taking, or whatever thing you're on. And drunk is a deep pathological condition resulting from the use of alcohol, food, or pills. Taken together, they suggest intoxication without alcohol. A dry drunk is intoxication without the use of alcohol, food, or pills. Intoxication comes from the Greek word poison. Isn't that interesting? I never knew that until I was researching it. The word intoxication means poison in the Greek. A dry drunk implies a state of mind and a mode of behavior that are poisonous to the alcoholic, overeater, or the pill addict. Now let me read it again. A dry drunk implies a state of mind or mode of behavior that are poisonous. We understand very well that if we take alcohol in our system as an alcoholic, it does not burn up and go through the proper channels. It goes into our bloodstream, to our spinal fluid, into our brain. And in the overeater, we know that carbohydrates and sugars turn to a poison in their system. Carbohydrates turn to sugar with the bloodstream, the spinal fluid, and the brain. And we know what pill addiction is. Now, when we're doing the things that we used to do, when we've been abstaining or dry from the thing we put in our body, we are then again in the state of intoxication, or what is known as a dry drunk. And as long as we can recognize these things, we don't have to have the wet drunk. In other words, we don't have to go back to our problem. But if we don't recognize the things in our character that start to pick up again, we can end up in trouble. And I'm sure you've heard many people in OA say, you know, I was abstaining for a couple of years and everything was going along fine. And before I knew it, I was binging and I don't understand why. And when I've talked to them, I can see this poisonous behavior set up and getting an idea in your mind that things are all right and you can handle them now. Now, some of the manifestations that we will see that come from our dry drunk are grandiose behavior. Now, I know that you'll all take everybody else's inventory and see somebody and say, oh, they're on a dry drunk. But how about taking our own? Find out where we are in grandiose behavior. And grandiose behavior manifests itself in we overestimate our own abilities, our intelligence, and our judgment, or live beyond our means. Listen to that one. We exaggerate our own importance at the expense of others, and we're rigidly judgmental in our outlook. We're tensely impatient of life and others. We expect immediate satisfaction to our demands. That got me. We expect immediate rewards for our efforts, and we expect immediate release from stress or pain. Now, you're not going to remember all these, but when you hear these happen, if you identify with it, remember then, you are intoxified again. You're in intoxication. You're in poisonous thinking or behavior. If the sought-after satisfaction is not quick enough forthcoming, the reaction is to become indignant or depressed. Let me repeat that. If the sought-after satisfaction is not quickly enough in forthcoming, the reaction is to become indignant or depressed. People come to me in my counseling and they'll say, I've been so depressed. And it's hard for them to accept the fact that if they are depressed, it's because they're angry. And they're either angry because their satisfactions have not been met, or somebody was promoted over them, or somebody's not treating them right, and so they are depressed. And what it is actually is anger instead of being expressed out and ventilated to our sponsor or our people, we turn it in on ourselves and first become indignant, which is the first sign of anger, and then we become depressed. Now, these things left unattended can set you back on your next drunk or your next binge. And these are the things we're trying to not only tell you how to obtain and maintain sobriety, but also how to spot the things that will happen after you've been sober. Because some people are suddenly taken drunk and they don't know why. And it's because they've been in a dry drunk for a long time. And if you keep in contact with your sponsor and you keep working the program, you can spot these things in yourself. And what we're trying to do is to stop that from happening. Another thing that we can watch out for that is a manifestation is that we're easily bored, very distracted, or disorganized. Our enthusiasm becomes most juvenile or short-lived. We're constantly dissatisfied with life or chronically malcontent. Now, when we become constantly dissatisfied with life, I've heard people say, well, I'm off the honeymoon. I went on a honeymoon when I got in OA or AA or EHA. I just came down off the honeymoon, and now I'm just going to have to start the nitty-gritty business of living. And I don't think that's true. I don't think any of us have to come off that first flush of excitement and wonderment and expectation of the program if we're willing to follow the steps and to grow spiritually. But we do become bored very easily, and boredom is one of the first signs of a dry drunk. You go to a meeting and you think, oh, I'm bored with this meeting. I'm tired of hearing that woman get up there and talk. I think I'll go to another meeting. Now, if the meeting is not in the answer department and they're living in the problem, I can understand that. But if the meeting is a good meeting and you're just bored and you think, well, I don't think I'll go to a meeting for a while. I'm getting kind of fed up with the program. These are all indications of a dry drunk, and they're danger signals, very much so. We must make a sustained effort towards self-discipline. We must grow in acceptance of short-term discomfort and pain. That was the hardest one for me, to grow in acceptance of short-term discomfort and pain. We have pain or we have discomfort and we just scramble around like a rat in a cage. We can't stand it and we'll do anything, most of the time something very destructive, to get our mind off of it and to stop the pain we're going through when we pick up another pain. Now, pain will not kill you. Isn't that amazing? I thought it always would kill me, but pain will not kill you. And if we can stand still and walk through the pain to the other side, the problem is solved. If we run or do something else to get rid of that pain, we will walk around the corner and face that problem again. We have to learn to walk through the pain to the other side, and then it's solved. If we don't learn from our mistakes, we are doomed to repeat the same ones. And so when I'm going through pain or discomfort of any type, I always pray to my higher power, please don't let me miss the lesson that's in here. Let me learn from this so I don't have to repeat it again. So many times I would do something, take a trip, or get real busy, or get lost in the program, or make too many talks, and I would forget about what was hurting, making me uncomfortable and in pain. And then that would all be over eventually. And then all of a sudden, boom, I was right back with in front of the thing, facing what I had run away from. And I'm tired of running, and I can never run far enough to run away from what's really bothering me, and that's me. You know, you can get on a plane and get from here to New York and get off that plane and step down those steps, and you've got your problem because it's you. You can't run far enough or fast enough to get away from you. And so we have to learn to make ourselves the nicest person we can be, because we're really the only ones we have to live with. We're the only ones we have to live with. Now, we have to start to realize the irony, the ironic folly of an alcoholic, an overeater, or a pill addict who thinks his life has suddenly become very manageable. Now, I'm going to take you through the 12 steps in the thinking of a dry drunk person. Let's see if you identify. We don't admit any longer that we're powerless over alcohol, food, or pills. Maybe we just scared ourselves into this thing. We've heard a lot of people talk about what they did when they drank and ate, and we're really not like that. But we like the program, and we're going to stay around. But maybe one day again we can go back to eating or drinking. Now, this thought was in my mind and never left for 16 months, and I drank again and almost died. That your life had become unmanageable? Well, now, wait a minute, we could say to ourselves, sure, it was unmanageable, and I got here when I was all screwed up in the head with booze and pills and food. But now that I've been clean and sober for quite some time, surely I can manage my own life. Look how well I hold down my job. Look how well I'm managing my family and paying my bills. So my life is manageable now. If you ever fall in the trap of not remembering that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, once an overeater, always an overeater, once an addict, always an addict, once a neurotic, always a neurotic. And that means today, tomorrow, and for as long as you live. If you forget that you are powerless over these things, today, tomorrow, and forever, and that your life is unmanageable today, tomorrow, and forever, you're in problems. Because this is a program for a lifetime. And we will never get well enough to be able to manage our own life and do it successfully. Now, you can try, and God knows my first 16 months was a perfect example. I was going to manage it. I went back to work. I was handling two teenage daughters and an apartment and a husband and a job, making 12-step calls and making pitches all over Southern California. I was managing great. I managed to get greatly drunk, too. And you can do the same thing. Now, I can do many things, and I'm very productive. And the AA book says we will assume our rightful role in society. We will take over the things that we can rightfully do, as long as we don't get in the management department. I've shared this with you before, and I think it's worth repeating. One night on the way to a meeting, we stopped at a boulevard stop, and I happened to look over to the right, and there was a service station with a great big sign under new management. And in going on, I thought to myself, you know, if I had owned that station, and I had sold it, and that guy put up that sign under new management, I wouldn't go back there and tell him how to pump the gas and lube the cars and what hours he should keep, because I have respect for my fellows. Besides, he'd kick me out of there. So when I turned my life and my will over to God, I simply got out of the management. When I realized my life is unmanageable, I took in a new manager. And so I have a sign that you can't see, but it says, under new management. Now, if I'm incapable of managing my own life, and 30-some-odd years of my life over here is a record of what happened when I tried to do it, I just simply want a new manager to come in and stay there. I don't want him to come in and clean up this little mess and then say, thank you, go out on the front porch and wait, I'll call you if I need you. I want him to be there at all times. But when you are on the starting of a dry drunk, you'll say, that's ridiculous. It's all right for those people. Maybe they can't manage their own life, but I can. I'm smarter than they are. And so I can manage my own life. All right, the second step, where we say came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, we've come to believe that there's absolutely no question of a doubt that we are restored to sanity. For the rest of our life, we're now sane. And sanity means sound reasoning. And if you think, I'm in perfect sound reasoning, I have no problems anymore, I don't go off on my tangents, I'm doing fine. If you start thinking this way, you're in trouble. Because we have a daily reprieve from our outbreak according to our spiritual status. And we can only do it one day at a time. As many of you know, I've been sober over 26 years. And I have worked this program on a daily basis. I can't work it into 10 years from now. And I can't stay sober on the 26 years. I must do it today. And every day I ask God to restore me to sanity or sound reasoning. And some days I am restored to sound reasoning. And other days I am as nutty as a fruitcake. And thank God, each day, whether it's at noon or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when I find myself out there in that unsound reasoning, instead of reasoning things out, I'm going on my emotions, I'm feeling, I then every day can take that step and come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Sound reasoning is what sanity means. And I was in unsound reasoning most of my life. And every day, on a daily basis, I believe I have to ask God, or to believe that God can restore me to sanity today. I often remember a little baby that called me, and she said, and she always prayed before, she says, when do you pray? And I was telling her the different times, and she said, well, I pray before I get out of bed. And she says, I can get in so much trouble between the bed and the coffee pot that I don't dare get out of bed till I pray. And that's a girl that's pretty smart. She doesn't even start her day of going to the coffee pot without getting in trouble. And you know, we have no guarantees what's going to happen when we get up during a day. Maybe the day will be beautiful and smooth, and then all of a sudden all kinds of waves are in our life and things are not going well. And we don't know. We have no crystal ball we can look into and say, oh, today's going to be a good day or it's not going to be a good day. Now, the third thing is to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him. And when you get on a dry drunk, you suddenly believe there is absolutely no reason to turn your life and your will over to God. You're doing it fine. And if you have turned it over, he hasn't done what you wanted him to anyhow, and so you're going to take it back and do it yourself. And so we think, well, it's all right, or we can even get up and say the words that we make the decision to turn our life and over to the care of God. And it's just like saying, good morning, the sun's shining. Doesn't mean a thing. But each day, again, we have to make that decision. to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. Now, if you think you can take care of it and you don't need him, you're starting on a dry drunk, because your actions will prove to yourself and everybody else that things are not going well in your life. Don't turn it over to God. Handle it yourself. After all, you've been sober a few years or abstaining for a few years. Who needs to do that? We truly don't have to do it anymore. It's in our care, and we're going to be fine with it, and we run into trouble. Now, when you're on a dry drunk, you are not about to take a searching and fearless moral inventory. You've done that damn thing 5 times, haven't you? Why bother to do it again? You know all about yourself. There's nothing more that God can reveal to you. You're Houdini. You know everything. And people say, how long has it been since you take an inventory? Oh, I took an inventory a couple years ago. What did you find out? I know all about myself. Don't ask. And then you come to the place where you admit to God, to yourself, and another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. But see, you're not wrong anymore. You don't have to admit you're wrong. It's everybody else that's to blame, you understand? If your husband would just straighten around, or your wife, or your kids, it's nothing to do with you. You've been abstaining, and you haven't touched your poison, and you're doing very well, and you're going to meetings, and you're helping other people. So there's absolutely no reason for you to admit to another human being you've done anything wrong. But you can tell other human beings what everybody else has done wrong, and then you're going to really work your program. And you're really going to get drunk, 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 too. And then it says there's no reason why we should become entirely ready to have God remove the defects. He's already done it, and now we're perfect. And besides, if we do find out we have a defect, we can take care of it. We can handle it. We'll work real hard on it. And we'll, by guts and willpower, by gosh, we won't repeat those same defects. We don't need an outside power to come in and help us. Now, you're laughing, but how many of you feel this way at times? I have people say to me, I realize I have this defect and I've worked real hard on it. Well, if you have a defect and you work real hard on it, you're going to just keep it there tighter and tighter and tighter. But if you have a defect that comes up, then you have to become entirely willing to have God remove it. And we fall in the trap with this syndrome of a dry drunk of not asking God, not even being willing to have God remove it. We'll do it. We can manage. We know we've made a mistake. We know we've lied. We won't do it again. Or we've cheated and we won't do it again. And it's no sense in telling anybody else, because after all, you've been around the program. What will they think? And when you fall into this kind of thinking, and it's much more common than you realize. I got the idea for this in my counseling of listening to many, many people over 3.5 years who don't really they don't even know what they're saying. They'll sit on the couch and I'll be talking to them and I'll say, well, what do you think the problem is? And they'll come out and tell me. I realize that I'm doing wrong. Another symptom of a dry drunk is when you admit you're wrong and then use the expressions, well, I'm not alcoholic for nothing, or I'm not a compulsive overeating for nothing, or I'm not neurotic for nothing. That's the way a neurotic acts, isn't it? And that's rationalizing and justifying your behavior. And it'll get you nowhere. And so we can't fall into these traps. So we can admit all of our faults, and we can talk about them constantly to people. And we have this terrible problem. And we do so much talking, we don't do any action. And we stay in the problem for a long time. And that's not applying the program. Now, we don't have to humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings if we're on a dry drunk or starting into one, because we are, as I said, we are going to remove them ourselves. We are very intelligent. We know all about the program, and we know exactly what to do. So we're going to do it ourselves, and we will never get any place that way. Now, when I was first on the program, we'll say, we made a list of all the persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And now, when you're on a dry drunk, you make a list of all the people who've harmed you and become willing to get even with them all. See how quickly you can take these steps and twist them? How many of you laid in bed at night and thought about the people that have hurt you? How many of you said, I know it's not right to have revenge, but... Now, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible when we were first on the program and we were working the program, except when to do so would injure them or others. And when we were early on the program and we were sober and not on dry drunks, we didn't go out and wash our dirty linen in the public at the expense of someone else and go and tell somebody something that we felt or said they didn't know. But when you're on a dry drunk, you'll go to that person and you'll say, you know, There's something I have to make amends to you for. I hated your guts at one time. Someone did that to me. Someone said I hated you so bad I thought you were opinionated and conceited and stuck up. But I don't feel like that about you anymore. Oh, boy. Just, you know, wipe me out. And so when we have amends to make and we want to really hurt somebody and we're on a dry drunk, we can go to people and say, you know, I have to make amends to you. I just really ripped you up. We were in a group the other day and they were all talking about you and I got into it and I added to it. Now, what are you doing to the person that you're making amends to? They're sitting there thinking, she was in a group that was talking about me, all of them, and she added to it. What have they done to me? But this person in their dry drunk thinks, well, at least I made amends. I told her I was sorry for what I said about her. You know, this is hard going. This is hard going. You don't do this. A lot of people fall into a dry drunk pattern of going to someone who's helped them a great deal that they call, quote, sponsor, unquote. And after a while, the sponsor will start to tell them to do things they don't want to do or tell them things they haven't done. And so they'll go to the sponsor and they'll say, you're fired. You know, like they paid them to be a sponsor, for God's sake. I've got another sponsor now. And the person who took a lot of time and a lot of effort, even maybe it didn't help, but you've got to remember they did try. And so when you want to change sponsors, you don't fire one and take on another. You have many people that can be your sponsor. So it was many years that my sponsor and I have been separated. And yet my early beginnings, my early foundation was laid down by her. And many times I will say my sponsor said, when sometimes I wonder, is she one that said it or was it some people after that that said it? But I know that my sponsor gave me a lot of love and a lot of help to begin with. And much of my foundation was laid by her. And when I went on to other people, I didn't fire her. I've never called anyone else my sponsor but the very first one. And that's not that I'm so smart and so good, but I just think that's the wise way to do it. And I would suggest you do that too. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve your conscious contact with God as you understand Him. Now, why do you have to pray and meditate when you have an absolute straight pipeline to God? We don't need to improve a conscious contact. We've got God. We're very spiritual. We're very religious. We don't need to pray and meditate to get that contact. We have it. Do we? We have it as long as everything's going good in our life. And the minute waves start to come or somebody starts to bang up against us, then we start screaming, where is God? How come He doesn't help me in this? When you set Him on the shelf and left Him there for a long time. You don't have to improve your conscious contact if you're in a dry drunk and you think your contact is solid. My contact with a higher power is only there as long as I seek through prayer and meditation to keep that contact going. And when I don't do that, which thank God hasn't been very often, my contact is good. Now, when I was on the Alaskan cruise, my hours were different. My whole mode of living was different. I slept late. I got up and ate breakfast and read the Princess Patter. And I'd be up on deck maybe walking around at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I had not even bothered to say the first three steps or prayed or meditated. And I would have that kind of an uncomfortable feeling, wondering, what's the matter? What am I not doing? And all of a sudden I think, oh my God, you haven't even reported for duty yet. A ship could sink, you know? If I don't pray, how's that ship going to stay on that water? But we break our patterns. And it doesn't take long for you to lose your conscious contact with God and start bitterly complaining against Him and even starting to think to yourself, am I conning myself? Is this self-hypnotism? Is there really such a thing as God? And this can happen quicker than you know. And so that step can never be taken differently. Now, why should we pray for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out? We know exactly what to do and what we want, don't we? Don't bother to ask for God's will. People say, sure, I want God's will, and go right ahead and do what they please. And what happens? The show doesn't come off very right, does it? The book says we think people don't treat us right. And so we start to exert pressure. And we become very sweet and loving and kind. And if that doesn't work, we become mean and egotistical. And don't all the other players know what we're trying to do? And don't they wish to grasp all they can out of the show? Are we not the authors of confusion even when trying to be kind if we can just get our own way? Now, getting your own way can go into many manifestations. It can go into manipulation. And this is great between husband and wife. The man comes home from work and he's tired. And we saddle up to him and say, hi, honey, I'm so glad you're home. And I cooked your very best, the meal you like the very best. Why don't you sit down till dinner's ready? Now, we forget that we didn't treat him that way the night before, and he's really tuned in to what's going on. Your battery's a big dummy. And then when we have his tummy full, because they say, don't give a man a problem on an empty stomach. And so we fill him with all this nice food, and then he sits back, and then we ask him what we want. Now, a man does the same thing. He'll come home, and he'll bring her a bouquet of flowers, and immediately she thinks, he's been cheating on me. But it isn't that. He's just trying to be very nice and kind, because some way he wants to have his own way. And so we're manipulators. We're manipulating all the time. Now, ladies, don't think that your man brings home some flowers if he's manipulating. But I'm saying that's one of the ways he can do it. And we have to watch out for doing that because we are wanting our own will. We do the same thing with our children. We bribe them instead of saying, no, you cannot go. We'll say, if you'll be quiet, I'll take you downtown and buy you a toy. Or if you don't behave yourself, I'm going to take you to the doctor and he'll give you a shot. They used to do that. They come in the pharmacy and the kid would be raising the devil and they'd say, I'm going to take you back to the doctor. He's going to give you a shot. Now, when they do have to take the kid to the doctor for a shot, he's a basket case. But this is what we do, getting our own way. And so if we're doing that, if we're trying by any way, manipulation, cunning, any of those things to have our own way, we are not asking only for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. And you will be in pain and you'll be under stress when you start to get your own way. Now, you can talk. A husband and wife can talk and converse and give each other ideas of what they're supposed to do. And if a woman has one idea and a man has the other, and you talk, that's all right. You have a right to your opinion. And the Bible says it's a wise man who listens to the counsel of his own wife. But I'm not saying that it's what's for the good of the family, not some little thing that she wants for herself. And we're all guilty of doing this. Now, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we can buy that. We've had a tremendous personality change, haven't we? We are spiritually giants. We just walk around just floating off into sunset with our halo. And physically, we're just really great. And mentally, why, we're so sharp that once our brains started getting back to place, we just can tell you all about this program. So we've had that. We'll concede that. But why try, after all this time of really working hard, to go out and carry the message to others? Let the newcomer do it. We've put in our internship, haven't we? Don't get up at the meeting at the break and look for the people who raised their hand for the first time. No, sit there and chat with somebody you talk to on the phone all day long, 7 days a week. But don't carry the message to somebody who's new and maybe frightened and don't know what the hell we're doing here and thinks we're all crazy anyhow. And when you get a 12-step call and it may put you out a little bit and you have to give up something you want to do, don't do that. Thank God when we called, somebody came to us. And so we have to try to carry this message. And as far as practicing these principles in all of our affairs, that's downright stupidity. Why should we practice these principles in our affairs now that we're sober and abstaining? Practice them when you're drinking and eating, sure, but not now. Now, these are all exaggerations of how the 12 steps can be twisted and manipulated and misused. This program to me, and it's my opinion, is like the atomic energy. You use this program and use it carefully and right, it's going to be the greatest boon for you that's ever come across your path. But you misuse this program and it can blow you straight to hell as atomic energy can do. You cannot misuse this thing. This is divinely inspired, laid down by God for the likes of you and I, that can take us from hell into heaven if we want to follow it. And if we don't, and we want to do it our own way, don't be surprised when you're in pain. Don't be surprised when you're under stress. Don't be surprised when people don't like you. Don't be surprised when people aren't as friendly as they used to be. And one of the worst manifestations that happened to me in the first 16 months was the grandiosia. The fact that I knew better than anybody else, I was smarter than someone else, I wasn't as bad as those people. And this is the worst state you can get into. Expecting too much pats on the back for what you do. Now, whenever anybody comes to me at the end of a meeting when I've been speaking, or at this meeting, I'll say, I can't tell you how much you helped me. I will say to them, you thank God for that. And I've had people say, don't be so modest, Dottie. And I said, I'm not being modest. If I had stood up there and told you my ideas, God help you. But when I ask God to use me and speak through me, if you're helped, you better give glory to God, because it's He who has done it, not myself. And so watch out for the dry drunk. It can happen and creep on you so fast, especially if you get to the place where you're doing well for a prolonged time. We can get lulled to sleep. and we forget then to remember that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once an overeater, always an overeater. Once an addict, always an addict. Once a neurotic, always a neurotic. Now you say, that's not right. How can you keep saying that? What are we doing here if we're always going to be alcoholic, neurotic, and overeater? We are going to be that way the rest of our life, but we can arrest these things, and we can live comfortably in spite of it and be productive as long as we remember where we came from. The greatest way for me to be pulled back and pulled up short when I get cocky is to remember where I came from. Someone said to me not too long ago, how can you remember your last drunk? 26 years ago. And I tell them, if I've forgotten my last drunk, I haven't had my last one. But I can tell you what I looked like when I got to AA. I have a vivid picture in my mind of a woman that looked about 65 years old, who was in her beginning of her 30s, who weighed 82 pounds, who was suffering from malnutrition. The taste buds on my tongue stuck up like porcupine quills. My mouth was split open at the corner, and I had all these bumps under my neck. And I was half insane. Now that's where I got on my own. And that's where I can go back to if I live through another drunk, and I don't think I will. So I've got to remember where I came from and never let myself slide one step back into that past again. I want you all to come up after the meeting and take a look at this beautiful little machine that's just being taped on because you bought it for me. This is my AA gift from the group, and I'm so delighted with it. It records, and I can listen to all my tapes, and it's really great. I've never had a chance to bring it, and so once again, I'll thank you for it. It's really a lovely, lovely machine. So we have to watch out for these manifestations to come across. Now, we can also have manifestations of the opposite, like I told you, the grandiosa and the idea that we're so smart. We can get to the place where we want attention so bad that we start to bellyache and gripe and complain to people about how bad things are in our life, and they are not that bad. Now, we've all done that. We used to call it cry poor mouth. That's an old Western expression, where you have enough to get along, but if you complain to somebody about how tough things are and how you're having trouble getting groceries and everything, maybe, just maybe, they'll invite you to dinner. Or if you complain very bitterly about, gee, I want to go to those meetings, but I just can't get a babysitter, and you're talking to someone who has an older girl that may be babysitting for you, you know, for nothing. We have to watch out for these things, because we are very tricky. We are cunning, baffling, and powerful. We suffer from a killer disease called alcoholism, compulsive overeating, drug addiction, and neuroses. And so we have to watch out for the way we manifest. We either terribly, terribly great, or we're terribly, terribly sick, or we're terribly, terribly good, or we're terribly, terribly bad. We're not a middle-of-the-road people. I often think about the story that I told in AA years ago about not being in the middle of the road, never being able to deviate at all. If we went down this aisle and out that door every Monday night and there was a guy standing there with a baseball bat to hit us in the head, we wouldn't think of going out this door. We'd walk right down that aisle and out that door every Monday night. Now, if we got there and he wasn't there, we'd wait for him. And so we are not a middle of the road. And don't fall in the trap now trying to work this program perfectly, because there's no such a thing as perfection on this program. There is only progress. But the reason for talking about the syndrome of the dry drunk is because I've seen it manifest itself so many times. And some of this has been deeply exaggerated that I've told you, and I think that's the best way to get the points across to you. But if in any of these things that I told you, you find yourself doing, start writing about it, start talking to your sponsor about it, ventilate it, and say, you know, I found myself doing that. I'm thinking, you know, I can manage my own life, and I'm not, I don't have to work the second step. I'm totally sane now, and I reason everything out. When you start falling into this trap, you'll know what's happened, and it's insidious. You won't get up one morning and decide to do this. It'll just creep back into you as easy as it can. Now, another thing that I can do is look back on my thinking, not only my physical appearance when I got to AA, but look back on my thinking and see the things that almost drove me crazy. And one of them was my morbid and neurotic imagination, where I would take thoughts and throw them into my imagination, and they'd come out morbid every time. If my husband was late coming home from work, I would throw that thought into my imagination, and I'd see the police at the door asking me if I'm Mrs. Shore. They'd take me down in the police car to the morgue and pull out this slab, and there'd be a mangled body in there called Al. And I'd go through the whole funeral. I'd have six Al-Anon pallbearers and six AA pallbearers. I'd try to get sober. I was going to keep it in the group, you know. And I'd buried about 1,500 children in my mind who have died in childhood, and both my children are alive and well on the planet Earth. Now, I have to watch out for that in me. I can get into the place of being projecting something. For instance, not too long ago, I was too tired. I had made too many talks during the night, during the week. And one day in my counseling, four people canceled in one day. Now, they had legitimate reasons. They either had sick kids or they were going on a vacation. And I took that thought and threw it into my imagination. And I was down at the welfare, claiming welfare. I was going out looking for a job in pharmacy again, you know, trudging along with my poor tired legs. I went through the whole thing for about 15 minutes. And thank God for my second step. Oh, Father, restore me to sanity, to sound reasoning. 99% of my counseling is in His hands. I do the 1%, that's all I can do. And it picked up, and those people came back, and everything was fine. But I threw that thought in my imagination, it came out totally morbid. So I can fall into the thinking patterns that I did before. Very easy. Now, I have a loneliness thing that hits me. And different psychiatrists and psychologists have said it was the first 2 years of my life when I was in the buggy and didn't walk for 2 years, that those, and not being picked up and held, those were crippling years. And I think everyone in this room loves me. God knows I love you. And yet I can convince myself that nobody loves me, that I am totally alone, and the only reason anybody loves me is because I can do something for them. And I'll go on with that, but thank God not for so long. Not for so long that it devastates me. Now, for a little while, when I heard about my grandson, I threw that in my imagination, and I had him, you know where I had him, I won't even go to say it. But I have to stop those things. Now, the only thing I can tell you that I've improved in my thinking is that I don't think that way very long. If the phone rings in the middle of the night and wakes me up, before I answer that phone, I say a little prayer that somebody hasn't died. If somebody delivers a telegram to me, I just can hardly open it. You know, they don't deliver telegrams anymore now, they call you on the phone. But any of those kind of things, immediately I react in negativeness. Whoa, what's going to happen? Something terrible's going to happen. And so I have to watch my thinking. And if I had to do it by myself, God have mercy on me, I never could have done it. But I have a step that applies. And last week we talked about what step applies. And all day long, every day of my life, I tell you truly that I work at least 5 to 6 steps. Maybe different steps. I work the first 3 every morning, and I work the 6th and 7th much, and I'm constantly calling somebody and admitting to them something I've done that's wrong. And I'm trying to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And I never get bored with this thing. The one thing about this that's so great is that the enthusiasm and the love for Alcoholics Anonymous have stayed with me the whole time. It's ever new, ever exciting, and always changing. And so take your own inventories, friends, and see if somewhere in your life today you haven't manifested a little bit of a dry drunk. And if you did, stop it. Because it can stop. You can stop it now or go on for the wet drunk, because it'll hit one way or the other. Now, we're going to have a coffee break after we have the basket, and I want to have one for questions later, okay? Has anybody got any questions they'd like to ask about a dry drunk? About any manifestations of it? Yes, Terry? Stand up, honey, so people can see you.
Hi, Terry. What happens when they say you're going to make this big amends to somebody and you go and set a big pile of stuff on, and then you walk away and you don't feel good, you know what you've done? Okay, now how do you go back to that person and say I'm sorry?
Did
you just go back and say I'm sorry for
jumping the load you dumped, did the person know you had done it? Or did
yes, I mean, he's literally saying, and I hated you because...
But did they know it? That you hated them? So you have to be careful when you go to somebody and say, I hated you, and they didn't know you hated them. Is that what you did?
I don't know. I think she has an idea.
The one thing I like to answer this question with an answer is saying, don't make direct amends to people till you screen it with somebody else. Because, you know, we get all exuberant, we want to wipe away the wreckage of our past, and you go to somebody and say, I hated you. Now, maybe they thought you didn't like them, but when you put the words, I hated you, into, you know, out into the ether, and they hear that, sometimes they're in a state of shock, or sometimes they're hurt, and they can't answer you back. Now, if you've made the amends, and you didn't feel any better, you probably shouldn't have made direct amends. But you did it, and the amends are over, so forget it and let it go. Don't go back and dig around in it again. But this is a very, very, very tricky thing, where you find out that you've thought or done something to a person and they didn't know it, and you go to them and admit it to make yourself feel better. You will not feel better. So don't take this step. until you screen it with your sponsor or someone else, because the person you talk to is mostly emotionally removed from it, and they can think the other person's feelings and your feelings and can give you a little bit better advice on that. Now, we're supposed to first make a list of all the people we've harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. Then we make direct amends, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, like going to a woman and saying, I shacked up with your husband. You know, now that's making amends, hurting her and hurting him if she didn't know it. That's kind of a broad way to put it, but I mean, use your common sense. Ask God to restore you some reasoning. And don't go out and try and make yourself feel better at someone else's expense. Very wrong to do this. Now, another thing is when you make direct amends and you've talked to it with people and they've come to the idea you should do it, and you go and you don't have a good rapport with that person, and they don't say, oh, that's all right, you dear little thing, I love you and I forgive you. That's all right, too. The results of our amends cannot have any effect on us if we've done the thing we're supposed to do. I told you about the time I went to the groceryman, and he'd charged us a lot of groceries, and we moved from the area, and I just moved out and never left him a forwarding address or anything, and it was months after I was sober, realized that I had skipped on this bill. So I went back, feeling very virtuous, and went up to him and told him who I was, and he remembered me, and I said, I want to make amends to you. I never should have walked out and left that big bill. And he said, you sure in hell shouldn't. He said, every night I prayed you choke on every bite of food you ate till you paid that bill. And I said, I didn't say anything. I didn't feel good when I left there. See, I would like to have him said, oh, that's all right, I understand, and pet me and make me feel real good. And that doesn't always happen. I had to make the amends by paying off that bill. When I paid the last dime that I owed him, I felt good. And so be careful again of the feelings. To work this program, we want to have everybody pat us on the head and say what darling little people we are, because we're working such a good program. When half the time, some of the people never did the things we did to begin with, so they don't have to make amends, you know. And so I think that's what you did. I think you made amends when you shouldn't have made direct amends. Anybody else? Yes, dear. Passing through the pain?
Yeah.
Walking through it. Don't run away from the pain. If there's pain in your life, if it's emotional pain, it means there's something wrong in your life. And you don't run away from it by pushing it down or forgetting it. You stand there and work through it with someone else. Say you're going through a divorce. I went through a divorce. Very unhappy thing to do. And I could have done many things. I could have ranted and raved about it and talked about it and made everybody miserable about it, but I realized it was over, it was done. This is the way it's supposed to be, and so I tried to work my program in the pain. I couldn't work the program after I got through with the pain. I worked it in the pain. And I admitted I was powerless over the situation, that my life was unmanageable. I asked God to restore me to sanity, that I could live by myself, that I didn't have to have another human being in order to make me a complete person. And I kept on walking, working the step, till the pain started to lessen. But most of us don't walk through the pain. We sit in it and stew and talk about it and worry about it and dream about it and cry about it and never get out of it. Or we run from it. And many people who are going through a divorce will find somebody immediately and get married to another man right away on the rebound to try and show people that they're not the failure. So that's running away from the pain. Walking through the pain is sitting there saying, this will pass. It will not kill me. This too will pass. And turning it over to God and asking him to help you in the pain. But many of us make many destructive decisions to get away from pain. Or decide to quit a job. Or I'll hear people talk to me in counseling and they're unhappy on their job. They don't like their apartment. They don't even like California. So they're going to quit their job, move from the apartment, and move back east. And that's going to make everything fine. No, it ain't. You don't make any kind of big decisions when you're in pain. You stay there and work through it and then make your decision if you're supposed to leave the job. But we scurry around like rats trying to do something in order to feel comfortable. So let's make this pain go away. Yes?
I heard you say this direct amends, then what's going to feel?
Well, when you can't make direct amends, when you hurt somebody or others, then you talk to your sponsor about it, you mention God to yourself and another human being, the exact nature of that wrong, and then you take it to your higher power. That's right. That's right. But you don't go directly to someone and hurt them. And as many people come to me and say, well, my parents dead, or my friend died, or they moved away and I can't find out where they are. Fine. You don't have to make direct amends then. What you do is recognize what you've done is wrong. Admit it. Take your fifth step on it. Admit to God, to yourself, and another human being the exact nature of this wrong, find out why you did it, what was underneath it, and then forgive yourself and ask God to forgive you and let it go. See, we drag all this damn past just like a great big ball and chain, like we have to do penance the rest of our life, and we don't. Cut the dead past loose and let it go. Learn from it, make amends when you can. The main thing is learn why you did it. The fifth step says, admit to God, to yourself, and another human being the exact nature of the wrong. Now, supposing you stole. All right, you can say, I stole. But what's the nature of it? Why did you steal? Why did you feel the need to do that? What was the fear behind you that you wouldn't have enough or that you're going to get by with something? Get down underneath and find out why. And when you can't make direct amends by admitting it to someone else, at least keep with it long enough to find out why you did this. If you hated somebody, why did you hate? Where did they threaten you? Did they threaten you on your social life, your financial life, your home life? Where were you threatened that made you, end up hating somebody that bad or doing something to them? And if we find out what the nature of it is, we can learn from it and go on and not repeat the same mistake. Because you can steal for the rest of your life and go around making all these amends and keep on stealing. Or go on lying. Or go on doing these things if you don't know why you're doing them. Get down underneath and find out why you're doing it. And you don't have to repeat it again. Anybody else? No more questions? Yes, dear. Stand up, honey, so the ones up here in front can see you.
You mentioned, we don't need another person to make a person. And for this is where I'm starting to believe that. But then that takes me into the direction, what do you need from another person? What are your self reasons?
Well, we need them for companionship and for fellowship. And it's God's will that a man has a woman and a woman has a man. And we have to have a man or a woman together in order to have children if you want children. There's many reasons why we do. But see, what we do is we depend on persons, places, and things to the extent of God. And we think if we can't have this one person, we can't live. And we've really broken the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And many women, when they're divorced or separated or their husbands died, feel like they're half a person without a man. And that's too bad, because they can only be half a woman that's going to a man then. You have to be full within yourself and be able to live by yourself and function by yourself, and then you have so much more to give to a relationship. But to say I can't live without this person is ridiculous. We can live. What we're saying is I won't live without this person. And so you can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and a man, or if it's the other case, a woman. We have to be total human being by ourselves, and then we can add to this relationship. But many people get married not because they love the person, but because they are totally, either financially or emotionally, dependent on another human being. And people human beings have feet of clay and will always be let down. We almost let other people down, and we don't mean to. We can't be all in all to somebody. And when we're in a relationship, the thought is, what can I add to this relationship? Not, what can I get from this person? The minute you're in a relationship and you say to yourself, what can I get out of this person? What can they do for me? You have no relationship. You have the selfish, self-centered thing that the book says is the root of our problem. But when you think about, what can I add to this relationship? What can I get to this man? What can I get to this friend? See, we're grabbers. Give me, give me, give me. We're with God. Give me this, give me that. We're this way with other individuals, and we've never learned how to have a one-to-one relationship or be one of a group or be a friend. People sit and say, I have no friends. Well, it takes a friend to have a friend. And friends are like tender plants. You have to nurture them and keep them going, or they'll die. They'll wither and die. Most people say, oh, she's a wonderful friend because she does so much for me. And that's what maybe most of us consider friends. It's, what can you do for me? And these are warped ideas we have. But the book says we cannot look to persons, places, or things for our happiness. We have to look to God for our happiness. And when we become a total human being, where we can give and not grab, we've got a good relationship going. You hear many married people say, well, this is a 50-50 proposition. Not so. Because if I do my 50% and he does 49, I'm mad. It's 100%, 100%. You don't ever draw the line and say, I've done my share and I'll sit back and wait for them to do it. Same thing with friendships. You have to give totally of yourself in order to get something back. What you plant, you will reap. And many times the AA book says if we lean too heavy on someone, they will either flee or die. That the only person we can lean that heavy on is our higher power. And we do sometimes lean too heavy on human beings. And they just feel smothered, or they run from us. And we're not supposed to lean on persons, places, and things. We lean on our higher power. And when we do that and we find out what we can add to the relationship, then the thing is, just goes smooth before him. Anybody else? Yes, dear. Would you stand up with the in the back?
Could you repeat the forgiveness prayer?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Now, for those who haven't heard this, this is a prayer of forgiveness. If you find out that someone's hurt you, or you're angry or resentful for somebody, if you keep that anger and that resentment in your heart, it will stop your forgiveness from God. Because the Lord's Prayer says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive. Or you can put it this way, if we forgive. And so being perfectly selfish, I want total forgiveness from God. And I therefore must forgive my fellows. And I don't care what anyone's done to you. You say, I fully and freely forgive X, put the name there, to the best of my ability. I cut them loose and I set them free. They are free and I am free. Now, under no condition do you repeat this forgiveness prayer for the same offense, because that's just to repudiate your whole prayer. You've said it, to the best of your ability you've forgiven, they're free and you're free. And from then on, every time this person crosses your mind, you say, God bless them. If you have to do it 1,000 times a day, God bless them, God bless them. And the Bible says, if you have an enemy, heap blessings on their head. Don't heap coals of fire because you attach them to you.
That happened to me this week. I prayed to God for the opportunity to blast my boss.
To blast him?
Yeah.
And ask God's help.
Yeah.
I wonder what God said when you heard that one come up.
Yeah, I got blasted. I have had an absolutely terrible week with my boss, who was just been, and I just realized tonight that I brought it on.
Do you believe that what you plant, you will reap? And you planted it and you reaped it. And when we reap it multiplied.
No, I'm good.
That's right. When we plant something, we reap it back multiplied, shaken together and running over. It's the same thing when we do good. It comes back to us that way. Multiplied. And so in the Bible it says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. And the biggest trap you can get into is when you say, I'll fix him. I'll fix her. Because in the fixing of him or her, we get fixed. Every darn time, it's like you throw out a boomerang, and it goes out and it takes his head off, and it comes right back and takes your head off, too. And so, it's hard for us to forgive, because we get wounded. But you see, when people say to me, I can't forgive her, they are saying that they are incapable of doing that. And that's not true. We're capable of doing anything that any other human being has done, given the right opportunity or the set of circumstances. We are capable of doing it. And so the thing that I like to do is, if I don't like somebody, and usually when you're angry with someone, you don't have much affection, I don't want them to go to bed with me. I don't want them to take a shower with me. I don't want them to eat at my table. And I've got them handcuffed right like that. And it makes me mad to lay in bed angry at somebody who's sound asleep at home not even knowing I'm mad. That burns me up worse than anything. And so when you cut them loose and set them free, you break the handcuffs, and you're free. Now, you can say, God bless them for as many times as you have to, but when the Lord blesses something, it has to change. Either the person will be out of your path, or they can be there and you don't think anything about them anymore. You're free if you continually bless till that feeling comes. But be sure and keep blessing for how many long it takes. Don't repeat that same prayer for that same offense. Now, I've gotten to the place, thank God, when I say my Lord's Prayer. When I say, forgive me my trespasses, I stop and I ask the Lord to reveal to me if there's anything I have against anybody. And if there is, then I'll do the prayer of forgiveness immediately. If there's no answer comes, then I just give a blanket blessing to anyone that I can think of and then go on. Now, there's a place in the Bible that says, if you have aught against any, which means you have anything against anyone, you must not take your gift to God. You must lay your gift down and deal with that and then pick up your gift and give it to God. And I've shared this before, but I think it's worth sharing. Catherine Marshall's book, Beyond Yourself. She went over to England, and she was walking through Henry VIII's castle, and she was so resentful of him, of what he did to Christendom, because with all of his wives and killing them off and getting married, he'd really split Christianity right down the middle, and she was so angry. And when she went back to her hotel that night, she realized that she had aught against a man who'd been dead 400 years. Now, listen to this. She was so tied up in knots over what he had done, and he's been gone. And so when I was reading it, I thought to myself, do I have aught against anyone? And the first one that hit me was Hitler. And I have so many Jewish friends who were, you know, their families were wiped out and terrible things. And every time Hitler's name has been mentioned, it just curled me. Now, he's been dead a long time. And the hardest prayer of forgiveness I had to do was say, I freely and fully forgive Hitler to the best of my ability. I cut him loose and I set him free. He's free and I'm free. And bless Hitler. You think that isn't hard to do? But you see, now I have no feeling about Hitler. Because vengeance is the Lord, and he will repay for what that man did. We don't have to worry about Hitler. Now, another one that crossed my mind was Nixon. And every time I hear about Nixon, it makes me sick. I think that man almost, you know, almost took over the dictatorship of this country. And I just hear his name, or hear he's going to be on television, or read a piece in the paper, and just the word Nixon would do it, and I had to give the prayer of forgiveness for Nixon. Now, it's not only people in our acquaintance, but people we wipe out. People say, I hate all blacks. You know, we put people in a bunch like grapes. Or I hate all Jews, or I hate all Christians. I hate all Irishmen, or WOPs, or terrible things they call people. And this is terrible to do this. And you are putting a condition on your own forgiveness when you won't forgive something that someone did to you. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive. So if you're saying, but I can't forgive Susie, then you're putting that condition on God's forgiveness to you. And the prayer was given to us by Jesus to pray to the Lord. And so I want to be free. I don't want to hang on to anybody. I don't want them handcuffed to me. And it's most important that we come to terms with them and forgive them. Whenever I've said to myself, how could they do that? How could they have done that to me? And I pull back for a minute and I think, I could have done the same thing they did if I walked in their shoes, lived in their mind, and was in that same circumstances. I am capable as a human being of doing everything that anybody else ever did. Even to the sniper that got on that building and killed all those people down there on that campus. If I was in his shoes with his insane mind and walking in his body, I could have done that too. So don't stand in judgment and say, how could they do that? We're sorry they did, and we hope they never can understand why they did, but we cut them loose to get free. Okay? Anybody else? Yes, Patty.
Well,
I
need to work on this myself.
I have so much. Stand up so the people in the back can see.
Up
so they can see you back there, dear.
Losing our conscious contact with God, you know, in the dry drum. And although I'm feeling in a good place today, I know that happens to me, and I wish you'd discuss it, because someone discussed it with me at the break. And I really didn't have the answer.
Losing your conscious contact with God when you're a dry drum?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're a dry drum, for one thing, you've taken over. You just pushed God outside, and you've taken over, and you're managing your life, and you want total credit for every good thing you do, and there's no credit to God. So of course you break your conscious contact with God. The only way we can have a conscious contact with God is to be what we call humble. Now humble is an honest look at yourself as you are and a sincere desire to be as you know you should be. That's humility. And if you actually have an honest look at yourself as you are, you're not going to say, look how great I am, look at all the good things I do, but rather say, look what God has done through me. And so when we get on a dry drunk and we become full of grandiosity and we want an awful lot of pats on the back and we want full credit for everything we've ever done and we get out there with ego, then you have simply turned your back and walked away from God. And so, of course, your conscious contact's broken. So AA book says, no human power can relieve alcoholism, compulsive overeating, pill addiction, or neuroses, but God can and will if sought. And if anybody sitting in this room doing any good thing or thinking any good thought, you better give credit to your higher power. Because if you don't, you break contact right like that. Now, we're human beings. Have you ever been on a job where you made a suggestion that would change something very nice and your boss goes around telling everybody what the wonderful thing he thought about? Have you ever had that happen? Boy, you're so angry. Or if you're in a you're on a committee and you're decorating and you got the idea of how to do it and did a great deal of the work, and someone comes in and says, look what I did, you'd be very angry. They're taking credit for what I did. Now, we can understand that. And yet, every good thing we do, we take credit for, and every rotten thing in our life, we blame God for. We lay it at His feet. Boy, if people would blame me for what they blame God for, I would just shrivel up and die. He kills babies and lets them drown in pools. He makes cancer happen. He gives riches to one and withholds from the other. Oh, what a crackpot we have for God, if that's what He is. Every rotten thing that happens, we'll say, what did I do to deserve this? How can we have a good God and He lets this happen? But do one good thing and walk around saying, look what I did, boy. I did that all on my own. And we're really mixed up on where the good and where the bad is. If we are in trouble, or if a child gets drowned, it's because the mother did not watch the child. Now, as far as illnesses are concerned, we are in a mortal body, and when we were born to die. And somebody, you know, you think, all of a sudden someone passes away, and you think, how could that happen? Like, we didn't know there was going to be death. It's like Christmas coming, you know? We all get scurrying around the last 2 weeks before Christmas like we didn't know there was going to be Christmas for 11 months. And so it's our stinking thinking that causes all this. Okay? I think we've reached the end of the time. Did you enjoy the meeting? I certainly thank you all for coming, and I hope you'll be here next week. And now we have prayer request time. For the new people, we lift up whoever you want to. You don't have to remember the names of other people because the Lord hears them. And after we have that, we'll have a moment's meditation. I'd like to ask Beatty just in the Lord's Prayer. Start over here. Any prayer requests?